So many of you might know that Media at McGill is a hub of research and scholarship outreach on issues pertaining to media, technology, and culture. We're housed within the Department of Art History and Communication Studies at McGill University. And tonight's event is part of our larger focus this academic year on the subject of media and participation. And in fact, it follows a large-scale international symposium that we held last November called The Participatory Condition. And for those of you who weren't there, you can access archives of the videos on our website, media.mcgill.ca, or on the colloquium website, pecon.ca. But you're here tonight for a conference on participatory medicine, a term that might already be familiar to many of you. It refers, on the one hand, to some of the changes that we've seen taking place in medical practice, but also medical culture, occurring with the growing use of the internet, of mobile and social media in healthcare contexts, and the various forms of knowledge sharing that are associated with the technologies grouped under this umbrella term, participatory media. For some of you, participatory medicine might also evoke images of telemedicine, doctors who have the ability to screen their patients' medical data at a distance or monitor their vitals in real time using tablets or cell phones, and even perform remote surgeries using telecommanded robotic tools. But the notion of participatory medicine is perhaps most strongly associated with the activities surrounding so-called e-health and the e-patient movement, patients who use the internet in order to both seek out and share further knowledge about a diagnosis, about alternative treatment options, to engage in a dialogue with healthcare practitioners, or to consult with their peers in online patient communities or support groups. But the practices that we're going to be looking at tonight expand these definitions of just what participatory medicine might entail. The SAT Saint-Justine Living Lab and the web-based project Le Cura each draw on the possibilities afforded by contemporary media in order to move health towards what we refer to as whole person care. And in their distinct ways, as we will see, they contribute to reframing the culture of medicine around objectives that were first set out by the World Health Organization as early as 1946, according to which health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or suffering. So our first speaker tonight is Patrick Dubé, who directs a living lab in partnership with the Société des Arts Technologiques, or SAT, and Saint-Justine's Children's Hospital here in Montreal. His presentation will address how healthcare centers can function as social hubs for innovation using the living lab approach. And the second part of this evening will consist in a conversation between Media at McGill's postdoctoral fellow, Alessandro Delfanti, and Art is Open Source members, Salvatore Iaconesi and Oriana Persico, who will discuss their project La Cura, a web-based experiment in crowdsourcing a cure for cancer. Presentations will be followed by an open Q&A with the public. So I'll introduce our first speaker, Patrick Dubé. After obtaining a master's degree in anthropology and conducting his doctoral studies in geomatics, Patrick Dubé started a career as a research scientist in the field of healthcare ICT. Since 2006, he's helped organizations enhance their creative and innovation practices and methodologies. He has been directly involved in several open innovation initiatives with cities, corporations, nonprofit organizations, and citizen communities. He currently leads the SAT Saint-Justine Living Lab. He heads the Montreal Table of Living Labs. And he is also the co-founder of Umwelt Service Design and the co-director of research at the Société des Arts Technologiques. Please join me in welcoming Patrick Dubé.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move probably during the presentation, so I'm going to stay. I'm not going to sit down. Hello, everyone. I'm very pleased to be, I'm very honored to be here tonight at this event. Salut, Duncan. At this event on participatory medicine. I'm going to show you examples of how hospitals are now getting back to their original function of social hubs from examples all around the world, I think. And I'm going to discuss a little bit about also what we do here in Montreal with the Living Labs at Saint-Justin. But first, let's discuss a little bit the rationale behind it. Well, nowadays, most of us agree that to question and to improve the usability of our healthcare system, it necessitates to go beyond the user-centered, empathic design approach that we've been told during the last, I would say, 20 years, and go towards a more user-driven approach. It's important also to understand that now we need to link care delivery to the whole healthcare experience in itself, and to embody the patient-partner relationship in a culture of experimentation in the field, in real-life context, to reveal its full potential. So basically, the transition that we're seeing right now is that us, service designers, process designers, healthcare specialists, we are shifting from a design perspective to a posture of facilitator of co-design processes. But not all the co-design processes are born equal, and it's important to understand that before going further. For instance, these different methods of co-design can differentiate themselves according to their level of openness first, but also according to the way they manage the outcomes of the value that is created through the co-design process. It's a little bit of a mess today because everything is exploding. All methodologies are exploding at the same time. So a little bit of classification is very important to understand where the labs, the living labs that I'm going to talk about later, are positioning themselves in this referential. So first of all, if we're talking about crowdsourcing methodologies, well, actually, everybody usually can contribute to a crowdsourcing appeal. While if you take, for instance, the hackathons that are, not done on the web, but they are pretty much done in presential, you know, these events are associated to a selection process. And by the way, I would like to invite people here, if you already don't know, that we have a hackathon the 22 and 23rd of February in Saint-Justin. So if you are a patient, you are a designer, you would like to contribute, you're more than welcome. Okay. So right now we are going to talk a little bit more about another class of co-design model that is called the stakeholder coalition model. This model actually holds what we call the labs in open innovation, the living labs, the fab labs, the change labs, name it. Basically, this model is also a model where you have usually a thorough selection process of all the stakeholders that can participate to the co-design process. But the outcome are usually managed in a way that you want basically to create a 360-degree value for all the stakeholders. So basically, this model necessitates an intermediation process because the collaborators that usually are involved in that kind of co-design process are non-natural collaborators. They have divergent interests, and they have also common goals, but these divergence needs to be intermediated. The living labs fall in this category. Basically, if you go on Google and you search for living labs, you will find at least 15 different definitions. But at the basics, if you come back to the basics, you will see that they all share some kind of elements, of common elements. First, it's not a place, it's a methodology. A living lab is a methodology of open innovation that is basically relying on a public-private people partnership, a methodology that is also that sees innovation through usages discovery. Okay, so basically, you want to. I always say that in a living lab, you don't develop disruptive technology, you develop disruptive usages of existing technologies, basically. And you will involve users very early as co-designers or co-researchers in the co-design process. Why? Because they are specialists of usages, and you will experiment in a real-life setup, usually. It's those four, I would say, characteristics are the most important differentiators of what is a living lab compared to another modality of open innovation. Why living lab? Well, actually, we try to understand better technological and service adoption behaviors on the meanings point of view, the situations point of view, and the context of the usages. And we also, as I said, be able to enable a 360-degree value creation. So, as I said, users are not at the center anymore. They are part of the stakeholders. We are talking about a user-driven model, not about a user-centric model. The user, usually in a living lab, will be integrated in the process from the beginning to the end of the innovation process, and they will be integrated in the planification phase, the conception phase, the prototyping phase, and the final development deployment phase. At each phase, there will be co-design processes, there will be experimental processes, and there will be co-evaluation processes. So, living lab, they fall in a category, in a unique, kind of a unique category. They are different from pilots, from test benches, from focus groups. They are in their own category, in meaning that they rely on the fact that the user are active and where the experimentation is done in a real life setup. Living labs are actually a strong trend. You see a lot of living labs around the world. ENOL, the European Network of Living Lab, actually holds certified almost 350 living labs in more than 40 countries right now. They are in interaction with thousands of SMEs, with hundreds and of thousands of users that are organized in communities, and they are also in interaction with hundreds of public organizations. So in the field of healthcare, living labs are very well represented. They are they constitute about 10% of the whole sample of living labs throughout the world, and they were the most active growing field in 2013. If we try to segregate in categories of application the living lab in healthcare, you will see that most of them target the ambient assisted living for the elderly. Some of the other living labs will target the wellness problematics. Not a lot of them will target hospital care, and some other will target telemedicine application. Usually people tell me, what's the value? What was the point of this? What kind of value do you expect out of a living lab? Well, actually, there is no unique answer. It depends from the point of view of the stakeholder. But for a user, participating to a living lab is a way to empower themselves, to get literacy, digital literacy, to foster inclusion, to improve their quality of life through the new technologies and the new services that will be produced. For companies, living labs are interesting to reduce the cycles, the development cycles, the risk, to get a better alignment of the market also. For researchers, living labs represent also an inductive research approach. So it's getting, well, it's in French we would say redonner les notes de noblesse à la recherche inductive. It's a very interesting approach to try to get new hypotheses that you will test further down the road. So that was the part that I wanted to explain about living labs. Maybe right now what I suggest is that we go through some inspiring initiative that targets specifically the hospital or healthcare centers, living labs throughout the world. I have some examples here that are quite inspiring, I think. So we'll start right now by the Fabrique de l'Hospitalité. Fabrique de l'Hospitalité is a living lab that is located in Strasbourg in France. It's a living lab that is dedicated to the co-design of public and private spaces, experiences in the hospital. It focuses not only on the delivery of the care delivery, but on the time spent at the hospital. This is an interesting thing, because usually living labs are quite interested by the care delivery itself, but this living lab is trying to understand how the whole experience at the hospital will could be co-designed or co-created with the user. You have two examples here that are interesting. You have just on the top right, you have a maternity space that was co-designed with women's to be able to socialize in an environment that is quiet and where they can also deliver care to their babies. While at the left, you have some users that while they wait for a care or they wait for something, they are called to go outside and to think about the new buildings that will be built in the hospital complex. They are part actually of the reflection of the thinking process around the development of the hospital itself, and not only related to their health problem or health situation or health condition, which is quite interesting. You have the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. They developed recently what they call a high hub. It's a place where they produce several hackathons. Hackathons, for those who don't know, they are 48 hours events, bringing together different kind of professional, and they do that usually to produce some prototypes after the 48 hours. And this is a very interesting case of hospital doing regular hackathons. You have the San Pau Hospital in Barcelona. This hospital is trying to enable the user-driven innovation approach through an animation of dedicated rooms in the hospitals. You have a citizen room here, an R&D room, and a demo room that has been implemented very recently. The citizen room basically is a place where people can learn about health, medical devices, and you know, like normal people, like just us citizens. The R&D room will connect people with designers, with developers, in order to get the emerging ideas towards a research project. And you have a demo room where SMEs can come and see if there is some opportunities for them to commercialize the innovations that is created in this hospital. In Milano, which we were just talking about it, there is also the San Raffaele Hospital that is basically used in a very interesting way, actually. It's a lab, it's a living lab, where the process is to take the 20,000 people that go there each month and to make them experiment on technologies. Well, these are mainstream health technologies that will be deployed after a while in the civil society. Can be in a grocery, can be in the schools, etc. So they work a lot with vending machines that use neurogastronomy principles to help kids make healthier choices, stuff like that. It's very interesting. And you have here the Humanité complex that is pushing the envelope a little bit more and bring the living lab methodology to the district scale, basically, trying to co-create lifestyle policies around the hospital itself. And you have here the living lab Stade Saint-Justin, and I'm going to talk about a little bit. So for those who don't know the SAT, maybe I'm going to try to explain in 1 minute just what SAT is. SAT actually is it's an artist center. It's a hub. It's an artistic hub. It's a place where young artists can come and develop their practice, basically. SAT is a place where it's a center of creation and production in digital art. It's also a knowledge transfer institution, and it's also a R&D center. This is probably the less known part of the SAT, the R&D aspect, but it's worth mentioning. Here you have the building itself, the SAT with the dome on the top. The dome is actually at the same time a production device but also a research device. And we have three fields of research at SAT. We have immersive scenographies. Basically, we are very interested by everything touching immersion. It led to the development of several devices in the last 15 years. We have an interest also in intelligent interactions, and we have also an interest in network experiences. I'm going to get back to that in the Living Lab project. People at SAT basically are artists, researchers, and creators. They are computer scientists, experienced designers, but they are also explorators of new technological usages. This is interesting because it's very, very coherent with the Living Lab approach. So thinking about, talking a little bit about the Living Lab SAT Saint-Justine, SAT got the certification, Living Lab certification in 2010, and the partnership with Saint-Justine started in 2011. Basically, this partnership is has a very simple goal, rethinking the hospital experience with a generation of digital native, not for them, but with them. It's a project that involves a lot of people. You have the researcher creator at SAT, you have the developers, you have seven departments at Saint-Justine: hemato-oncology, psychiatry, rehabilitation, pain management, humanization of care, health promotion. You have also some research groups that are associated to the lab and contribute from a research, clinical research perspective to the lab. And the goal, the basic goal, is to reduce anxiety, to develop, well, actually, to develop usages of technologies that were developed at SAT first, and to develop new usages with patients in order to reduce anxiety, de-dramatize the medical devices and material, to improve their empowerment, to develop their socialization skills, and also to help develop new therapeutic protocols. We are totally in line with the World Health Organization definition of health, actually. So the intersection between the social sphere, the physical sphere, and the mental sphere are the basic model that we are based on. And basically our project are located at the interface between those spheres here. So one of the projects that we have is to use immersion, so virtual reality in rooms, in private rooms, to study the effect on anxiety therapy, to improve the sense, the feeling of familiarity, and also to experiment with pain management, patient with pains, basically patients that are burned. We are trying to see how virtual reality can create cognitive illusions that will help them reduce their perception of their own pain, actually. You have here a device that we use. It's a dome that is closed that we use to experiment on this kind of content at the SAT before bringing this to the hospital. We have another project that is using telepresence, immersive telepresence. Basically, it's a way to mediate the relationship between a children and a therapist through telepresence. Usually in psychiatry, you will have a doctor that will be in another room. It will take the appearance of an avatar that will be defined or selected by the children, and the child will be on the other side. Week after week, this avatar will be humanized, okay? And after a couple of weeks, it will look like a human being, basically. So the goal is to desensitize some patients that have a hard time entering into therapy, okay? Another application of that is to use exactly the same principle. Another usage is the same principle, but rather than use it to engage the patient more quickly in the therapy, is to we use it to keep a therapeutic tension between the clinician and the children. For instance, we have children who are stuttering, and they express these clinical symptoms when they are stressed. We are trying to keep a level of stress that is high enough for those children to practice their communication skills, and the immersive telepresence is part of the device that we use to maintain this therapeutic tension. We have also other devices that we're developing to help children create. Create with what? Create well, to do storytelling with everything that they have at hand. So pretty much we are using a very simple device here that is very inexpensive to make them tell stories with the medical material that they find on their way in order to express their feeling, but also to de-dramatize this material after a while. They can create, ils peuvent créer des œuvres that are collective or individual. Another project that we're starting right now is called the House of Justin Justin. It's a project that uses immersion in order to prevent accidents through empathy, meaning that about 50% of the patients that we have in surgery at St. Justin are patients who got their injuries at home. Because of a bad management of, you know, like the knives and the casserole and all the pots and stuff like that. So what we're trying to do with this project is to develop a device that we will bring in the civil society. We will bring it to the malls, okay? And we will try to make parents use the device to explore a domestic space through the eye of children of different age, to see through their eye what kind of object are appealing, what kind of object are not appealing at different ages, and we'll try, you know, through empathy to help them manage in a new way their domestic space. Okay, I'm going to present you here a very short video just explaining the methodology. It's one session, Living Lab session at CHU Saint-Justine with psychiatric patients that you will see. The goal of this project was to understand how immersion could help those children develop metacognitive skills. Those children were hospitalized and they were in transition actually from their hospitalization to the real life. So this project was to see if immersion could be like a mean to help them develop metacognitive skills, to help them get back to the real life.
On est bien, on n'est pas jugé, on peut travailler ensemble, découvrir qu'on a sa place dans un groupe. C'est beaucoup ça quand on parle de ça.
You will see a couple of clinicians in this video. Patricia Garel, who is the director of the head of the psychiatry department. So basically the process is in four steps. First, we expose them to an experience. After that, we go to a more reflexive session with them about what they just experienced. We're trying to make links between their experience and real life scenarios that they lived recently or during their hospitalization.
Est-ce que ça crée plus d'effet que ça soit abstrait ou trouvé?
Ouais, c'est entre les deux.
Quand il y a de l'abstrait, il y a plus d'incertitude dans. Je crois que moi, j'avais plus peur.
On dirait que ça fait plus référence à vraiment ce que les émotions, des choses qu'on peut vivre sans nécessairement les relier à.
So after this reflexive part, the goal was to get downstairs to a co-creation room where the artist and the teenagers, part of the study, the project, were co-creating content with very simple means, content that could inspire artists for the next session, creating new immersive content that we would experiment again and again and again and again on. The goal being that after the project, converging through a content creation that would, from their point of view and from the clinical point of view, get to the goal that is developing metacognitive skills. So we did realize a lot of interesting, we did see a lot of interesting observation in this project that I'm not going to have the time to go through, but after that, no problem, we can talk about it. Just to finish, what is interesting with Living Labs is that you can initiate a thinking process at different scales at the same time. At the same time, you will be interested by the artifact, the experience, the behavior, and also the meaning that you associate to the whole healthcare system you're in. But to make this process successful, it's very important that our healthcare centers reconnect with the very concept of hospitality and get back to the basics, seeing healthcare centers as social hub where we have a unique opportunity to bring diversity and proximity, those two words together, where we need to create dialogue spaces between the doctors, the patient, family, the citizens, and where we interrogate engagement and adoption of healthcare services and not only their efficiency or their efficacy through user experience. It's important to see in others difference, a source of creativity and innovation, and not only something to normalize. So to build a society of co, it's important to have trust, and to have trust is important to be generous. So I'm going to finish with this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. I'm going to introduce our three next speakers, Alessandro Delfanti, Salvatore Iaconesi, and Oriana Persico. Alessandro Delfanti is a postdoctoral fellow at Media at McGill, where he works on the role of participatory media in contemporary biomedicine. He also teaches sociology of new media at the University of Milan and is a member of the research group on science communication at CISA in Trieste. As a journalist, he writes about science and digital cultures for several Italian newspapers and magazines, and he is the author of Biohackers, The Politics of Open Science, published by Pluto in 2013, in an English version and in an abridged Italian edition as well. Salvatore Iaconesi is an interaction designer, a robotics engineer, an artist, and hacker. He was a TED Fellow in 2012 and an Eisenhower Fellow since 2013. He teaches interaction design and cross-media practices at the Faculty of Architecture of the La Sapienza University of Rome, at ISIA Design Florence, at the Rome University of Fine Arts, and at the IED Design Institute. And together with Oriana Persico, he makes up the core membership of the group Art is Open Source. Oriana Persico holds a degree in communication sciences. She's an expert in participatory policies and digital inclusion. She is an artist and writer. She has worked together with national governments and the European Union towards the creation of best practices and research standards in the areas of digital rights, social and technological innovation, digital business ecosystems, and practices for participation and knowledge sharing. And they will be discussing the project La Cura. Please turn your mics on.
Thank you, Tamar. And well, I want also want to thank Patrick for sharing his ideas. And there are lots of similarities, I guess. Well, even though in the case that we're going to discuss now, we're not talking about practices of participation or interaction or co-production that happen in hospital rooms, but in something that happened leaving an hospital room. Is that right? So the dialogue space was created outside the hospital, at least at the beginning of the La Cura project, as you will know in a few seconds. I just wanted to kickstart their own presentation of the project because Salvatore and Oriana are at the center of the project that we're going to present. That in order to create forms of participation, in this case with La Cura, what was at the center, let's say, of the stage was data. So data that which were not accessible. So we all produce incredible amounts of data in our daily lives. That's also true when we're patients, when we get ill. We produce incredible amounts of data in forms of blood tests, brain images, as in this case, any kind of information that we provide or that hospitals produce around us and with us and around our bodies. But those data are not always accessible to us because they can be buried under non-disclosure agreements, for example, in case of pharmaceutical trials, or concrete vaults in some cases, passwords, firewalls, or maybe they're just not meant for us to use them. So they're not made for us. They're made for professionals that use them in some ways, but that they also prevent the owner of those data, the people that provided them, to use them in unconventional ways or in unexpected ways. So this is my start for this debate, and I wanted to ask Salvatore which kind of data, which kind of very personal data he couldn't access and why.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having us here. Yes, data. I hope you don't have any experience on this, but if you do, you probably know what the first thing that happens when you have cancer. When you have cancer, when you are diagnosed with cancer, the first thing that happens to you is that you disappear. Your life as a complex human being goes away and is replaced by a very simplified and encoded life under the form of the patient. So you disappear as a human being and you become a patient. And the patient is a very peculiar object, and I don't use that term lightly, because the patient is an object who is described, whose life is described in terms of data, as Alessandro was saying, images, exam, lab values, doctors, everyone around you, friends, relatives, don't talk about you anymore. They talk about the data. So, for example, in relation to doctors, you could not be there. You could be absent as long as the data is there. The doctor would look at your images, like these ones. They would browse through some sets of values. And you could be absent. You could not be there. It would be the same. It wouldn't matter. This obviously opens also opportunities. But for the human part of yourself, you could not be there. It's very interesting. And also, all the people that are around you are basically dealing with the patient. So before even saying hello, they go like, what do the doctor say? How is your pressure? How's your images? Did something show up? So it's a very peculiar condition. You disappear, and the patient is left, this entity, this entity which is made up from data. And let's talk about this data. While I was in the hospital, right after the diagnosis, I asked to have an image of my own cancer. Because I wanted to look at it. So I wanted to look at the image of the cancer and, you know, talk with it, look at it. It's usually a taboo to look at the image of the thing that is growing inside of me. It was not possible to obtain an image of my cancer. So I asked the doctor, the nurses, and it was not possible for many different reasons. I'll just expose one of these reasons. For example, the one objection, one of the reasons for which they were not giving me an image of my own cancer goes like this. What if we give him an image of his own cancer, telling him it's an image of your cancer, and then it's not a cancer and he sues us? It's incredible. It's pretty amazing. Also, I was not given an image of my cancer for privacy protection. It was my cancer. So you needed to go under a very peculiar procedure to access an image of my own cancer. I'm asking. So a whole series of different legal, privacy-related, insurance-related, procedure-related, bureaucracy-related reasons, I was not able to obtain an image of my cancer. And so something was not clearly working in the overall mechanism. And so I decided to leave the hospital because it was not really for me. Okay. Before leaving the hospital, I asked for my medical data in digital format. It took some time to obtain the data. When I did, I was very happy. I had finally a CD with my own medical data, and I was really happy because I was going to obtain the image of my cancer. I stuck it into the computer. I opened it, and what comes out is a DCOM file. If you know DICOM, if you know what DCOM files are, technically speaking, they are open formats. It's an open format. It's documented on Wikipedia. It's they have repositories. It's an open format, okay, by standard definition. What is really interesting, that is not meant for regular people to use. It's an open file format for professionals. You need special software to open it. When you open it, the terminology is different from the things that the software that regular people use. So that it is not for regular people. It's for professional doctors, researchers, etc., etc., etc. So even this file, which is technically speaking, it's an open format. Even that was not for me. If you think about it, it's amazing. Okay, I have my file, and all I can do with it is take it and give it to some other professional. I have no access. For example, my mother would not have been able to print out if she had cancer, which I hope she hasn't, never in her life. She would not have been able to print out an image of her own cancer because she wouldn't just not have been able to. And it's incredible. I did something which was the beginning of La Cura. I opened up these files and published them in forms that anyone could open them, forms that everyone knows, JPEGs, GIFs, PNGs, formats that everyone can use, it's forms that you can attach to emails. I published them online, and I started this website, which is called La Cura.
So here a different Salvatore gets into the picture. So not Salvatore the patient, like a more complex and bigger Salvatore maybe. And it's Salvatore the hacker in a way that gets into the picture at this point. So I wanted to ask Oriana in which sense this other Salvatore stepped in. And why that was important for continuing for starting La Cura.
First of all, hello to everyone, and thank you for having us here. And I will thank you also for the question, because it's a very interesting one. And what I will tell you is that it was a Salvatore again, not another Salvatore or the patient Salvatore. Was what I saw, because I was also a witness. Not only in the beginning I was a witness, and of course someone very close to all this process, and an actor at the end. What I saw was simply Salvatore doing what he does naturally with to technology, with software, with social processes. So what we do with Artis Open Source in our normal life was back again. And so thanks to this process, we were back again. And I had the immediate sensation, the immediate feeling, that was not only the beginning of a reaction, of any possible reaction to these things that happened in our life, but was also the possibility to live this experience in our own way, meaning that we were not we were in this case we were doing what we do through art, which is hacking this whole situation, and in a way, as Salvatore was doing with the code, so opening up the code and making it available to people, the thing was reversing our situation, and which is really what we do normally. And I want to also share with you the fact that this was the first real natural reaction, meaning that we were told, we were in 1 week at the hospital. So this story we are telling to you now is really our first days during when we were told about the cancer. So this was an immediate reaction, and was the natural reaction of Salvatore. So it was him, if I can tell.
Okay, thanks. And I think it's well, thanks for sharing this sort of hidden and deep side of how you live the whole story. And I think it's very interesting because I want to go back to Salvatore as a hacker, because of course he had the skills to hack into that code, to transform it into easily shareable images and so on. And but he also had the skills to set up a communication project, or if you want to use their own terminology, a performance. So a performance in which code was not important per se, so that those data were not important per se, but as in many cases when we talk about hackers, the openness of those data was a metaphor that maybe Salvatore will be able to explain that better to you. It was a metaphor for a more collective way for example, a more collective decision making in the health process. Or a new form of sociality, a more open form of sociality, a more inclusive form of participation in his condition. So what you did is that you created a new public space, an online public space. And what happened in La Cura?
Many things happened at very different levels. So you can have... The main thing that happened, and it's nice that, for example, you had the presentation first, because in some ways you're bringing sociality into, I'm oversimplifying, bringing sociality into the hospital. And what I did is exactly the opposite. So the most important things and most evident thing that happened is that the disease entered society. So different directions, really interesting possible interactions among the two. So the main thing is that, and we can intended at different levels, the patient left the hospital, meaning that the patient left the hospital and entered society. And this, of course, in this process of leaving the hospital and going back to society, into society, data is, as you said, obviously a metaphor. And for example, when I think about this, I think it in terms of in abstract terms, in terms of an open society, a possibility for participation. But I think of it as also in really practical terms. For example, we live in Rome. We live in Rome when we are not traveling, and I would say just a quick scenario on how things could be and what I mean to it by it. We live in Rome. When we are away from Rome, for example, coming to Canada, it's not like we can leave and nobody knows. In Rome, before leaving, we have to alert our grocery store, the bar, the man at the bar, the barber shop, our neighbors, because if they don't see us for more than 3 or 5 days, they would actually ring our doorbell. How are you? And if they don't find us and they haven't seen us for 3 days, they would get worried. Hmm? And this is an interesting concept, as simple as it may sound, because in a way it's an interesting concept. Why? Because in a way you cannot be sick alone. You cannot have trouble alone, because you have a whole society, my neighbors, the grocery store, the whatever, whoever is in your neighborhood, that's also part of your disease, of your possible not being well, of your care. You actually have the whole world, the whole society caring for you. Okay, and how is this possible? Through data. In this case, in our neighborhood case, it's a very peculiar data. The data we generate when we manifest ourselves outside. And so they see us. It's visual data. Okay. In this other case, in La Cura, this was the exact transition. So in this exact way, the data represents moving back into society. Okay, so I hope it's clear what I mean by it. So we were leaving the medicalized condition and entering society, so leaving the patients and becoming human beings again. This is a very breakthrough and important concept for us, and this is was the thing that we were asking people in La Cura, join us in our disease, okay? Be disease with us, because, because that's the way it is. That's the most interesting thing which can happen. Mm? And people actually understood what we meant. So, how can a designer, an artist, an ordinary person, an ex-patient, a regular person, obviously a doctor or a researcher, can provide me with a cure? And so things have started happening, from stories to people offering money, to people coming and visit us, to people telling us, okay, you should really come to Argentina on holiday, to several things. So people were starting to feel this shift from the medicalized condition to the society, the societal and participatory condition. For example, I just want to I'll show you one. For example, this is Francesca Fini. She's an Italian artist, and for example, produced a performance, an art performance on La Cura, and many art performances, for example, were produced. Imagine the effect for a cancer patient with his medical images being, for example, this happened in two different cities, being projected using architectural projection. So projected into a whole building facade as part of an artistic performance. Or for example, this is another example I love. So this artist is an American artist. His name is Patrick Lichty. Using the images which I published, produced a 3D replica of my cancer, and put it on sale on Thingiverse, which is a website in which you upload, you send 3D files, and people can download them or purchase them eventually, and reproduce them with a 3D printer. So he produced this 3D replica of my cancer, put it for sale on Thingiverse, and so now you can download it and you can have my cancer too. It's interesting from a participatory point of view. That's the least I can say about it. And so these things were happening. It was like a continuous state of translation from one state to the other. Data becomes society, patient becomes human being. And this process of shifting the context, we call it breaking the code, was the most interesting thing that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yes, absolutely. Ah, we're talking about the cures. So, for example, this is a zoom in and this is a zoom out of and not all of them, but really a lot of them, because we still catching up onto categorizing them of the cures which arrived. So you can see there are columns and each column has a label. It's like a bar chart. You can read it as a bar chart. So the more, the higher the bar, the more cures on a certain topic arrived. And if there is a connection between one of the bars and one and another one of the bars, it means that the person suggesting a cure, be it going on holiday, whatever else, be it a certain surgery technique, etc., 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 there is a relation between the cures that were suggested by a single person. Okay. Without filter, so everyone was basically able to join in. And we obviously used all this information to do a lot of studies, but that would be another completely different matter of discussion. But so you can grasp, and these are not, these are, I'd say, from the backlog, sadly, that we have, I'd say it's like 40% of the overall cures that arrive, which are more than 900,000. So to give you just an example of what was really happening. So what was really happening is that everyone who participated, and we're talking about something like around 300,000 people, everyone who participated felt part of a society, of a set of communities, even because there have been spin-offs of the La Cura project, so companies that decided to develop software, hackers who decided to do things, artists who are now spinning, for example, as Patrick Lichty, who have started their own thing based on La Cura, connections happening, for example, with the example, I hope you know her, she recently died, Beatriz Lacosta, which was a really incredible artist who produced a toolkit for cancer survivors. So there was also a really spin-offs of independent even from us. I did the visualization of La Cura, and I assure you I'm not the center of it, and this is the most beautiful thing. This is the most beautiful thing because it's a social process. It's a disease that has left the hospital and has entered the society, just like me.
Thanks. So one obvious question would be, yeah, but then what? So what happened? Which cure did you actually follow? What happened? And how La Cura helped you go through the whole process? And that's of course one of the main questions, and I'm sure that the public will also raise it in particular ways according to their experiences. And another one is, it's very interesting because you are very explicitly inclusive. So Salvatore issued a video on YouTube asking people to send him a cure. And he was very explicit in saying that the word cure in different cultures can mean very different things. So that an artist can provide a cure. And a cure is not just a pill or not just surgery. So it was very clear since the beginning that we were not talking about like crowdsourcing a technical solution for his cancer, right? So this will be a very wrong way to look at the project. So it was rather the search for a new form of collective care.
Absolutely.
If I interpret it well. So the question is, why you? Because why did you do this project, and mm-hmm. what could the other people do? Because there are of course several cultural peculiarities here. So also, first of all, because of your background as artists and hackers and people who are able to use the mass media and so on. But that's not enough. How about issues of nationality, gender, or how about people who don't want to share their data and participate?
Absolutely.
How do you see La Cura envisioning something for them?
Absolutely.
And, and quickly because I'm running.
Yes, yes, no. First of all, answering the first question, I'm obviously dead, so I'm not alive anymore. I'm replaced by a higher entity. I've had surgery and everything went fine. The second question is actually very connected to the first one, because what can La Cura suggest to other people? What's the takeaway? In a certain sense, I'm simplifying because of lack of time. The takeaway is the opportunity to change the things in which ways, the way in which things work. Because now we have this perception of now, for example, as we've seen also in the Living Labs, there is this encoded version of sociality. So there is a technical, when you have a disease, there is a technical problem. It's like going to the plumber. So there is a technical problem to be solved. And then there is a sociality kind sort of placed all around this problem, so you can do many things for assess and confront with the social political aspects of your disease. Okay, the La Cura, for example, the way I see it, at least, it indicates that all these tools, all these practices which we are adding to our own toolkit, our own available toolkit, are necessary but not sufficient to make things change. Okay, so we can have all the special effects, we can have all the open source formats, we can have all the open data, we can have all the quantify itself, we can have all the things in the world, but they are not sufficient. They are, of course, necessary, so openness in data, but they are not sufficient. What is really the other part of the process, of the process of changing things, are, from my point of view, and we can discuss all you want about it, I would be happy sincerely to discuss about it, are two things. The desire, desire on one side, because accessibility is not it does not equal freedom. Okay, so the possibility to access data, the possibility to access technologies is not equal to is not an equation with the freedom of being more free and open. What's missing is desire, the desire to use these things to achieve a larger amount of freedom, etc., etc., etc. And the other thing, which is very related to it, is the abandoning of the coexistence problem. Most of the time, when we think about these things, we think in or terms. So it's either a technical problem or a social problem. It's either instead we can what La Cura has shown is that from my point of view is that we can stop thinking in terms of or and we can start thinking in inclusive terms, in terms of coexistence of multiple approaches, from a polyphonic point of view, so in which many views, even conflicting ones, are represented and can form a discussion. And so this is my answer. Yes.
Okay, thanks. So we're done. Thanks for sharing your experience. Oh, very interesting. And very, I guess let's open the ground for questions.
We can open the floor to questions for Patrick and also for all of the participants. And we are equipped with these nice microphones, so please use them when you ask your questions. You can just press on the button and...
when we talk about participation, the question that arises in my mind is by whom, for whom? If we look at Quebec as an example, there's poverty somewhere between 20 and 40% of the population, depending on the group affected. The worst ones being children of single parents, of indigenous people, of seniors. So, in addition, here in Montreal, 50% of the students in the French school system drop out of high school before graduation. The statistics for the province is somewhere between 20 and 30%. So who are we talking about? It seems to me that although participation sounds good, and it certainly is very useful for those who are doing it, it's a privileged system that you're talking about. So how does one bring these new insights to deal particularly with those who are probably in greatest need of health improvement?
Was that a question for me, or
whoever?
Okay. That's. I'm not sure I understood all the question, but I'm going to answer from my point of view on the general topic. If we're talking about living labs, as I said before, living labs, it's a method. It's a methodology. This methodology can involve different kind of resources. In our case with Saint Justine, it's very highly technological resources. But I'm involved in another living lab where we're. In French, we call it maturité scolaire. It's a living lab that is dedicated to the development of the skills of children that doesn't get the right maturity to go at school after 5 years old, you know. And we are experimenting with parents that don't have a lot of, you know, of resources. They come from different origins, and basically we work on the community aspect with them. We work on building trust between families, exchange practices, practices on the education of the children from different cultures and stuff like that. So from a methodological point of view, I think that the question is very important, and I think that a living lab can be applied to different kind of contexts depending on the problematics, but it needs to be applied in the most inclusive way that it should and can be.
I have also a short answer. You remember that example that I did with my neighborhood? This for me points out a very interesting model. When we talk about, for example, La Cura, what happened with my cancer, we talk about it explicitly under the form of the emergence of a peer-to-peer welfare. What does it mean, peer-to-peer welfare? It means transforming healthcare, for example, but that could be applied to many other things. But let's stick to healthcare for now. It means transforming healthcare from something you buy, either directly or through your insurance or through whatever you mean, into something you do together with society. And this is a very important shift which we actively pursue. So this is my answer for this. And also I want to add that we probably would have had many more problems in doing such a thing as La Cura if we had not been in Italy. In Italy, my surgery came under the public national care. And it cost me 15 euros. The whole of the surgery, it cost me 15 euros. And so this is also a nice thing to talk about. It didn't cost me the, I don't know how much the, I don't know, in the US there is the blue cross, and I don't know which one you have here. It didn't cost me thousands of dollars to be able to access, it cost me 15 euros. Okay. So this is, between these two elements, so the emergence of peer-to-peer welfare, so meaning people caring about each other and developing the conditions which make people possible to care about each other, and there are multiple conditions, like social, political, psychological, and many, many more levels. And you know, the idea that taking into consideration other forms of public or even private, if it's done right, healthcare or things. This is, from my point of view, where the answers lie.
I will, if I can, very, very quickly, I will add that it's not the case that in Italy you don't have differences related to access to healthcare. Of course, there are areas of the country that are underdeveloped, areas of the country where healthcare can be rather bad, or at least rather different from other areas, and it's both urban against the countryside and the north vis-a-vis the south. So I don't think we're saying that Italy is this paradise of public health, but and then there are other, as you can imagine, there are several other layers of differences that we could add to this. So class, of course, nationality, if you're not Italian, so if you don't have an Italian passport, and so on. I just wanted to add this. I think the another point is that these projects and these scenarios shouldn't obscure those facts, that the fact that there are difficulties to access proper health care, there are macroeconomic problems, and so on. So of course that's true, but I don't think this should obscure that. But I don't think this it provides something else. It provides another layer, but it's not 100% related to that layer, of course, of those discrepancies that you were mentioning.
Just for clarification, aside of the economic question, which is what you've dealt with, I'm concerned with the educational one. How do we equip our publics to know more about health, how to prevent disease, how to deal with it, how to share information? It seems to me that that problem has not been adequately addressed.
Thank you. This question is for Patrick. First of all, I think what you're doing with Saint-Justine is fabulous. Really taking technology that we use as a consumer, whether it's a phone or a tablet, and bringing it into the business world, and in particular with healthcare and the kids. I have sort of more of a technical question. I was really curious about the virtual reality as it relates to the patient room. Yeah. Like, how are you doing that?
It's called video mapping. So it's a way to use projector that have a precision, submillimetric precision, so you can map on objects, basically. It's not only on a flat surface or on a dome. So you can have a room with a lot of heterogeneous object. If you know what kind of object don't move, you can map heterogeneous information on those objects, meaning that you can recreate a whole world that take advantage of the spatial configuration of the room, you know. So that's quite interesting in the case where, in some cases where children they feel, for instance, very compressed in the room, and they feel un sentiment de compression, là. You can expand the atmosphere just by projecting some information on walls or objects that are in the center of the room or stuff like that, you know. So does it answer your question?
Yes, it does. And how many rooms are currently in Saint-Justine that have this capability?
Oh, well, actually, you need to have quite a big room to do that. Actually, this project specifically has been only prototyped. So it's in the phase where we need to make this accepted by the ethical committee also. Our goal is to get a couple of rooms equipped with this in 2014.
Thank you. I have a question for Salvatore and Oriana. I was just wondering, how did you make it known, make it public that the project was happening? How did you disseminate the pictures? Through what networks did you go through? Who did you reach out to? Was it family, artist communities? Which kinds of networks did you go to make it, to popularize this?
Actually, it's a mixture of lots of different ways. In the beginning, things started happening on their own really, really fast. I basically published a video on YouTube, and I published it also on Facebook, on Twitter, and many people, friends, relatives, Facebook friends, so people I don't know but that I friends on Facebook, really started getting involved on their own. And then there was a major change of scale when networks, entire networks, started being alerted of what was happening. And it started when larger media outlets were getting involved. So a set of journalists were involved. So they, because they wanted to get the news out of this thing that was happening. I'm also a TED fellow, so the TED conference, for example, and so they were really, really helpful. I can see you. They were also really helpful in this, and so they helped me out. They immediately understood what I wanted to achieve, and so they were really helpful, and they helped me get in touch with lots of large websites, news journalists, etc. So when networks started joining in, the thing really grew in speed like radically, but in the first instance it was going on really fast on its own.
Even like too fast, meaning that we published the video and the day after we were in all the news, even on TV, major channel. So in the beginning and for 1 month we had the opposite problem. So we really were overloaded by journalists from all over, from Brazil, even from Canada. I believe Toronto Star, and other, even the TV in Canada called us, but we even filtered a lot the media relationship because it was even too much. So.
Really interesting that it went viral. It's
really cool. Actually, it's this was also related to the thing you were saying. Actually, one interesting thing that we could notice is that we also do this for a living. Our job is to also learn how communication works, how to break it, how to manipulate it. For example, one of the things that that have happened a lot is that some people did not, judging from our previous work, we've worked a lot with the idea of fake. Some people did not believe that this was really happening. Some people started also saying, also publicly online, you can find traces of it, also in this graph, started saying, oh, that's all fake, it's an artwork, it's a fake. So this also was really happening. An interesting thing is, and I agree with Alessandro, is that, okay, it's we knew how, we had the skills, we had the knowledge to make this happen. How can we interpret? How can we get better understandings out of this whole process to transform it into something useful that could happen in the broader society? So the tricks we used to make it really work really well are obviously interesting, but I think we should really stop and reflect what we can learn from it, and we're doing it. We're even writing a book on it, and to gain better understanding of what broader society can get from La Cura. So
I would love to just add a very small thing. I'm very agree. I don't know your name, but I'm very agree about the fact that we learn education, and it's all very. Roots, this is the roots of our society, it's not the surface. If I reflect, for example, we were pushed to learn a lot about cancer we didn't know before having cancer. And even through this broad process we were involved, we have learned many, many things. So. This is also we have learned from professionals, from peers. So even in a very complex way, which is not only the class or what we learn inside a specific place, but it involves us as a society again. So this process about reflecting in what we can do. As a society, is very important as individuals, and as a society as well. And even the fact that we were able to living this experience in a very personal way was very important. And as we were saying in the class with Tamar, I hope that we. These possibilities to personalize this experience can be an option, but it's a big question. How we do this is very large.
Maybe I would like to add something to that, if I may. It's very important that in Living Labs that you, you learn through experimentation. That's the way you learn. Okay, to become a user that becomes a co-creator, You need to learn about what you're going to co-create about. If I just get back to the example I was giving about San Paolo, there are three rooms, the citizen room, the R&D room, were made there just for that. It's to see the hospital as a place where you can go even when you're not sick. And when you're not sick and you remember that you were bothered about some stuff when you were sick before, you can go there, learn about it, and you can change it with people, you know? So that's, I don't answer your question probably, but it's the part of the answer that I can give you. It's a new way of making the civil society learn about health, about healthcare, about the system, about medical devices, about everything that we just don't control at all when we are sick and we're patients, part of a system that take in charge everything, you know? So maybe it's also a part of the question, I hope. The answer, I hope. Okay.
I'm not a patient.
I'm not a patient. Yet.
No. No. You are talking about this.
No. Language is important.
It's a joke.
Okay. I have a question. On the internet, there are various forums and blogs, etc., about various diseases. And would that be considered participatory medicine? I mean, what you've done is much greater in scope, and I attribute that to the fact that, as you say, you are professionals in media, so that you were able to manipulate your project in a professional way to reach people probably from various continents. But anyways, my question is, would you consider these forums and bloggers to be participatory medicine?
For example, one interesting, really, really interesting thing is that we did all this effort, enormous effort, global performance, the kind of effort that you use this word for, to achieve a very primitive effect. Because the effect which we achieved was on a large scale, on a planetary scale, the effect of my neighborhood. The effect of my neighborhood, in which if someone doesn't see me for 3 days in a row, they come and ring my doorbell. And this is very interesting. What's the difference between this model, so a society in which people, in which members of society actively care for each other, and forums? Forums and e-health portal and e-patient portals, what is the really big difference? The big difference is that of encoding. It's a big difference in the fact that these forums, these e-patient portal are about patients. So a limited version. They're not in society. They are outside society.
Even in titles, language.
They are outside society. So they are really, okay, they are participatory, they are inclusive, meaning that if you want, you can also join in if you're not a patient. But what's missing is society. They are outside society. Instead, we are describing a thing which is society. Which is very important, because everything we have around us makes us believe that healthcare is something you buy, not something you do with society.
A service.
It's a service which you buy, not something which you do together with society. Because when you take the human being out and leave the patient in, you are describing a service user. Which is not a human being, it's a different thing. It's a schematic version of a human being with all that complexity taken out. It's very useful. It's a very useful ways of limiting, because it's useful for bureaucracy, it's useful for administration, it's useful for business, it's useful also for science and research, because in all sciences, if you focus on certain aspects of a human being, certain values, certain aspects, certain domains, it's easier, and it's more productive too. But this is not a human being. So we are really interested in taking the human being back and learning how all these aspects can coexist in a space. So we're not saying that, the patient must go away. But the patient is like a part, a very definite and formalized and encoded part of a human being. This, for us, is breaking the code. Okay? So the effort is actually bringing the disease into society.
Oh no! Well, I can. I just wanted to say that it also, just to go back to your question. It really depends also on how you define participating.
Absolutely.
So if you want to adopt like a stronger political definition of participation, which means deciding together towards like a political goal, maybe most of those services and spaces that you were mentioning are not participatory. On the other hand, what happens there is that people do things together. So people at the very first level narrate their pathologies, their stories. They provide peer support, so in this sense they participate in somebody else's condition and problems. They share information, and so they feel empowered, because then they can go back to health institutions with more information, more knowledge, or what they perceive to be more means they have to negotiate their position within the health system. So I think it really depends on that. So if you want to stick to a strong definition of participation, maybe not. If you want to take this word as a broader term, maybe yes. Maybe in most of those places there are instances of participation that are very interesting to explore.
Absolutely.
I have a question for Patrick. You mentioned de-dramatizing the medical devices, which I think is very interesting, but I was wondering if you do something about, for example, the opposite of it, the medical devices that are simple, for example, inhalers or injectors, that patients think are too easy to use, and sometimes they don't read about them, how to properly use them, and end up misusing them. Is there something in those open labs, do you do something about that? Maybe in a better product design or research into better packaging or insert design or something like that?
That's a good question, because you're touching two different levels of processes that we have in the living lab. First of all, how can you use, for instance, games and all that stuff to make people learn about proper use or to explore new uses of a specific device? In this case that I was talking about, it was specifically the usage that emerged was specifically a de-dramatization usage, meaning that we gave all this technology to the children, and we just realized with time that they were creating stories and that they were not afraid anymore of the syringe, you know, because it became a space shuttle. So it was an usage that emerged from the experimentation with children. But in some project, as I said earlier, we need to develop the literacy of the user about the devices around him to make him a better co-creator. So that's a different process. We usually do it in workshops with users, but with a different goal, a goal that is to co-design something else, you know? So, but yes, it's taken into account.
Okay, thank you.
Questions. I feel like we've only scratched the surface of the potentials of participatory medicine expanded as we saw it tonight. But please join me in thanking our speakers.